Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is the Federal News Update for Tuesday, December 30th, 2025. I'm your host and guide, Alex Johnson, and I am absolutely ready to plunge into what might be the most active 24 hours of federal activity we've seen all year.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. And you're not wrong. We're about to navigate a truly staggering, almost exhaustive volume of decisions made across, well, every branch of government on December 29th.
Our mission today is explicitly granular, and it's tailored for you, the learner. We are going to dissect every reported action, every contract, every single policy rule issued by the U.S. federal government since the clock started on December 29th, 2025.
And this isn't just a news roundup. It's really a masterclass in this administration's strategic theme.
Which is?
The simultaneous consolidation of power and projection of stability. You see it in every single move.
Yeah, and what makes this one day, December 29th, so fascinating is the paradox of it all.
The paradox, exactly. On one hand, you have the administration orchestrating this intense, high-stakes international diplomacy. The kind that, you know, defines global conflicts.
And at the same time, announcing these colossal decade-long arms sales. And it's all happening from the so-called Winter White House at Mar-a-Lago.
But then, and this is the crucial part, that huge geopolitical activity was running concurrently with a massive $50 billion domestic intervention in rural health care.
Plus, all these significant, very political regulatory shifts on immigration, the federal workforce, national security, it was synchronized, high-intensity operations everywhere at once.
It was. It really shows a central control system that's incredibly effective at managing these diverse, politically sensitive portfolios all at the same time.
So let's unpack this, and I think we have to start where the global action was, which is the geopolitical theater.
Okay, let's do it. The entire diplomatic focus seems to have been split. It was defining a new security architecture in the Middle East, and at the same time, trying to resolve the conflict in Ukraine.
And the nerve center for both was Florida.
Right.
For about a 48-hour period, Mar-a-Lago was the global operational hub. The president had just wrapped up a critical meeting with Ukrainian President Zelensky on the 28th.
And then, what, no pause at all?
No pause. He immediately pivoted to host Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on the 29th. And we have to be clear, this was far beyond a routine check-in. This was explicitly a high-level strategic planning session.
And the attendance really signaled that intensity, didn't it?
It did. Secretary of State Marco Rubio was there, which is key.
Mm-hmm.
That ensures that the president's personal diplomacy is immediately, you know, aligned and backed by the full institutional weight of the State Department.
And the focus was on this new doctrine they're calling Ironclad Plus.
That doctrine is really the foundation of their attempt to project enduring stability in the Middle East, and it operates on three distinct and, I think, critical vectors.
Okay, so what's the first one?
First, they focused intensely on developing a regional security architecture, specifically an integrated air and missile defense shield.
This is that Middle East NATO concept we've heard about for years.
It is, but this is the concrete manifestation of it. It's not just talk anymore. The goal is to physically link up and seamlessly integrate Israel's highly advanced radar and interceptor assets with those of willing Arab partners.
So you're talking about a unified grid.
Precisely. A unified grid designed to provide comprehensive coverage against the growing threat of Iranian ballistic missiles and, of course, their drone attacks, its security through integration.
And that diplomatic integration leads to the second vector, right? Pushing hard on this classified 20-point peace plan.
Right. The discussions were all about moving beyond the existing Abraham Accords. This peace plan is incredibly ambitious. It centers on two major components.
Which are?
First, formalizing a definitive long-term end state for the conflict in Gaza. And second, and this is maybe the most critical piece, accelerating the normalization of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia.
The State Department readout was very specific on this, wasn't it?
It was very pointed. It emphasized promoting peace and stability consistent with this specific vision, which tells you this is the non-negotiable framework the U.S. is now pushing.
And then there's the third vector, which is something new. They've formally elevated the fight against anti-Semitism to a foreign policy component.
And that's a key elevation. It signals that the administration is leveraging U.S. moral authority and, you know, potentially conditioning certain relationships on the protection of Jewish communities globally.
So the ultimate strategic implication of the whole summit is what?
It's this. The administration is simultaneously reinforcing unconditional long-term military support for Israel, and we'll get to that massive F-15 deal in a minute, while applying intense diplomatic pressure for this integrated regional security system.
Okay, so let's shift theaters from the Middle East to Eastern Europe, because the Russo-Ukrainian peace track gave us the day's biggest headline, this so-called 90% solution.
Yes. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt confirmed President Trump held a, quote, positive call with Russian President Vladimir Putin that morning. It lasted over 2 hours.
And the public messaging was just pure optimism.
Engineered for maximum optimism. The president publicly stated the war is nearing its end and a deal is closer than ever before. And he characterized the negotiations as 90% agreed.
That's a classic high-risk triangulation, isn't it?
Textbook. Engaging Zelensky and Putin within hours of each other to try and force a convergence by projecting the weight of U.S. influence and, you know, this sense of inevitable progress.
But I have to ask, if they're 90% there, how significant is that last 10%? Because that's usually where these things completely fall apart.
That's the entire critical risk, and it is immense. The remaining 10% involves these intractable, almost existential issues.
Like territorial sovereignty.
Exactly. Territorial sovereignty over Donbass, and specifically the status of key assets like the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which Russia currently occupies.
And security guarantees for Ukraine, I assume?
That's another massive sticking point, defining meaningful, verifiable security guarantees. So you're right. If these talks, after being so confidently framed as 90% done, collapse over that final crucial 10%.
Then the administration risks appearing incredibly naive on the world stage.
Especially given Russia's immediate countermove. You've hit on the timing perfectly. What's fascinating is how Russia immediately undercut that diplomatic optimism with a very concrete military escalation.
The Oreshnik escalation.
The Oreshnik escalation.
Tell us about this system. It was announced as entering active service on the very same day as that positive call with Putin.
Moscow announced that the Oreshnik, which is a nuclear-capable hypersonic intermediate-range ballistic missile, or IRBM, had become operational.
This is a huge geopolitical power move.
It's a textbook example of escalate to de-escalate. It's designed explicitly to strengthen Russia's negotiating leverage during those very peace talks.
And U.S. researchers identified the deployment site.
They did. The former Khrushchev 6 aerodrome in the Mogilev region of Belarus. And the location is absolutely key to understanding the threat.
Because the tactical threat from Belarus is immediate and, frankly, terrifying.
Yes. From Belarus, Oreshnik isn't just a regional weapon anymore. It becomes a theater weapon. It is capable of striking major Western European capitals.
We're talking London, Berlin.
London, Berlin, Paris, all with flight times measured in just a few minutes. And the technical reason this is so terrifying for NATO is that it uses a hypersonic glide vehicle.
Okay, we need to simplify that. What does a hypersonic glide vehicle actually mean for NATO's defenses?
Well, think of it this way. A traditional ballistic missile flies in a predictable high-altitude arc, sort of like throwing a baseball. NATO's layered defenses, like the Patriot or SAD systems, are designed to intercept that predictable arc.
But a hypersonic glide vehicle is different.
Completely different. It enters the atmosphere and then it maneuvers at extreme speeds. We're talking Mach 5 or higher. It flies lower and takes unpredictable paths.
Which makes tracking and interception almost impossible.
For existing systems, yes. Almost impossible.
So the strategic impact is crystal clear. Putin is signaling that if this 90% deal fails, the alternative isn't just a long proxy war.
The alternative is a nuclear shadowed escalation right on NATO's doorstep, one that bypasses their best defenses. It creates immediate urgency for the peace track. It says, we are serious about ending this on our terms, or we will dramatically reshape the European security environment.
And while the administration was dealing with these, tectonic plates shifting globally, they were also very careful to project stability at home.
Through a very high-profile counterterrorism action.
The announcement from Attorney General Pamela Bondi and FBI Director Kash Patel.
Right. Regarding the Texas man charged with providing bomb components and funding to people he believed were ISIS operatives, it's necessary PR.
Why necessary?
Because the entire national security focus has shifted so heavily toward great power competition, Russia, China, Iran, that the public needs reassurance that the domestic apparatus is still vigilant.
So it's a message.
It's a message. This high-profile announcement, using the authority of both the AG and the FBI director, signals that counterterrorism against radical Islamic threats here at home is still a critical priority, not some secondary concern.
That makes perfect sense. And that global diplomacy, it requires this massive projection of stability through military strength, which is a perfect segue, I think, into our next section, because the diplomacy on December 29th was immediately translated into huge capital deployments by the Department of Defense.
They were activating the entire defense industrial base. The connection between that Netanyahu summit and these defense contracts is seamless. The contracts announced were enormous, and they cement long-term foreign policy commitments.
And the most significant one was the Pentagon awarding Boeing a contract for Israel's F-15IA acquisition.
The ceiling value here is just staggering. $8.6 billion for the design, production, and delivery of 25 new F-15IA, the Israel Advanced Aircraft, with options for 25 more.
But let's start with the domestic insight here, which I think often gets buried under that huge dollar figure.
It does, and it's a long-term economic lifeline. The work is slated for St. Louis, Missouri, and crucially, the completion date is set for December 31st, 2035.
A decade plus.
This massive decade plus commitment keeps Boeing's St. Louis F-15 production line hot for the foreseeable future. It preserves thousands of high-tech aerospace engineering and manufacturing jobs.
So that's the domestic consolidation of stability part of the theme, securing a key manufacturing base for the long haul.
Precisely.
Now, strategically, what does the F-15IA, which they're calling the bomb truck, allow the Israeli Air Force to do that its existing fleet, like the stealthy F-35s, can't?
Well, the F-15IA is optimized for one thing, long-range strikes against hardened, heavily protected targets.
So you're thinking underground nuclear facilities in Iran.
That's exactly what you should be thinking. While the F-35 is stealthy, it has limited internal payload space. It can't carry the heaviest bunker-busting munitions. The F-15IA sacrifices stealth for massive range, speed, and just an enormous payload capacity.
So by approving this specific sale, the U.S. is signaling explicit long-term support for Israel's ability to project overwhelming conventional force at very long distances without needing U.S. intervention.
It's a message directed squarely at Tehran. It's the hardware that underpins the whole Ironclad Plus doctrine.
We also saw significant sales to strengthen NATO allies on the northern flank, which seems like a necessary response to that Oreshnik escalation in Belarus.
Two crucial State Department approvals here. First, a $1.8 billion sale of P-8A Poseidon Maritime Patrol aircraft to Denmark.
And Denmark is vital for anti-submarine warfare, or ASW, in the Baltic Sea and the North Atlantic.
It is, and there's a real emphasis on ASW right now because of the palpable increase in Russian submarine activity in the Atlantic.
What are those subs threatening?
They threaten the undersea data cables, the backbone of the internet and global commerce, as well as vital shipping lanes. So providing Denmark with the P-8A, which is the premier ASW platform, ensures NATO can immediately track, deter, and hold those Russian subs at risk in that crucial maritime theater.
And the second approval was for Poland, a substantial $200 million blanket order training package.
Poland has been buying up U.S. hardware aggressively. I mean, they're absorbing Abrams tanks, Apache helicopters, HIMARS rocket systems, a dizzying array of sophisticated platforms.
This $200 million package, it's not for more metal.
No, it buys the essential software, so to speak. The specialized training, the logistic support, the doctrinal alignment. It's to ensure the Polish armed forces can operate interchangeably with U.S. units on the eastern flank.
Because without that training...
Without this targeted, specialized training, all that expensive hardware is just static metal. This ensures true interoperability, which is the very definition of NATO military stability.
Let's shift our focus now to the inside, to the modernization and cyber posture of the Department of Defense itself. We saw a new DoD memo that expands multi-factor authentication MFA options.
Yes, beyond the ubiquitous common access card, the CIHE. And this is a huge, long overdue policy shift.
But we need to define the jargon for the listener here.
We do. This memo addresses the reality that the physical CAC card is often, you know, impractical or infeasible in the field or in training or in remote environments.
So it gives them other options.
It provides crucial clarity by authorizing modern non-PKI MFA options like FIDO passkeys for 23 specific use cases.
Okay, wait. PKI and FIDO passkeys. Can you simplify what that means for security?
Of course. PKI is public key infrastructure. That's the core cryptographic certificate carried on your CAC. A FIDO passkey, on the other hand, is a modern, hardware-secure digital key, like a specialized YubiKey that is basically immune to phishing.
How so?
It's tied to your physical device, and it proves your identity without relying on a password that can be stolen. The memo clarifies that the DoD's core credential is still PKI, whether it's on the old CAC or a modern, approved alternative.
That sounds like positive modernization. But you mentioned this runs immediately into a cyber catch 22.
Yeah.
What's the contradiction?
The contradiction is that while it expands options, the memo fails to mandate phishing-resistant authentication across the board. It still allows legacy phishable technologies, like a one-time passcode sent via text message or email, for certain low-risk training environments.
That seems like a glaring vulnerability, especially since Congress has been putting enormous pressure on the DoD. I thought there was an FY 2027 deadline to retire all phishable authenticators.
There is.
So they just kicking the can down the road?
Security experts see it exactly that way. It's policy lagging necessity. While the FIDO passkeys are great, the continued allowance of these weaker links creates a pathway for sophisticated credential harvesting attacks.
So the DoD is just addressing the immediate operational need to get away from the CACs,
while simultaneously failing to fully heed the call for the foundational phishing-resistant security required by law. This memo will almost certainly need revision next year.
To dig deeper into that cyber landscape, we have some details from an interview with Kevin Rivera, who's the director of the DC3 Cyber Forensics Lab.
That's the Defense Department's Cybercrime Center. Most people probably don't realize this lab is at the center of both criminal and national security cases.
What's their mission scope?
It's massive, and it's two-pronged. They perform digital forensics on seized evidence, mobile devices, computers, laptops, even gaming systems, for crimes against or committed by DoD members.
And the other prong.
Crucially, they also handle the high-level malware analysis and cyber intrusion forensics for the defense industrial base. So when a contractor gets breached by a nation-state actor, they're the ones who come in.
And Rivera noted that one of their biggest challenges today is just the exploding volume of data.
Absolutely. He highlighted that everyone now walks around with a computer in their pocket, a cell phone, and correlating a criminal or espionage activity across multiple devices for a single person is exponentially more complex.
One person might have four devices.
And piecing together a timeline is a gargantuan task.
And the technical challenges are only getting worse because of encryption, especially in modern apps.
That is their most difficult technical challenge. As Rivera explained, bad actors are constantly seeking creative, encrypted ways to conceal their communications and activities.
But beyond criminal investigations, he raised a severe red flag about the state of critical infrastructure.
He did. Tell us about that vulnerability.
He noted that the DoD is urgently trying to focus on analyzing digital artifacts associated with critical infrastructure, because so many of these vital systems, think power grids, water treatment, old manufacturing plants, they rely on proprietary hardware that is often 25 years old.
And that hardware can't be updated.
Frequently, it cannot be updated or patched without breaking operations. And this presents an astronomical systemic vulnerability across major industry sectors that we all rely on every single day.
And the key preventive wish he offered, what was his advice?
It was simple but profound. He said people need to heed the adage, be careful what you click on.
Back to basics.
Back to basics. Phishing and spam, despite all the sophisticated defenses out there, remain the single greatest risk factor for identity theft and device compromise.
Okay, let's move on. The intelligence, oversight, and legal battles of the day provided a very clear window into the intense political friction and loyalty tests happening around the executive branch.
And we have to start with this unprecedented controversy at the FBI regarding security clearances.
The reporting revealed that FBI Director Kash Patel quietly granted polygraph waivers to three of his senior officials, Deputy Director Dan Bongino, Congressional Liaison Marshall Yates, and Executive Assistant Nicole Rucker.
This is a significant breach of protocol.
It is. Why is a polygraph waiver for senior staff so explosive?
Because the standard vetting practice for the FBI, and this has been in place since 1994, requires every single employee to pass a polygraph just to get a job.
And individuals needing highly sensitive clearances, like for SCIAF.
Right, SCI or access to the director's SCIF often need multiple polygraphs. So the expert consensus is that granting waivers to such high-ranking operational figures, especially the deputy director, is completely unprecedented.
And that's an extraordinary breach of procedure. Bongino, as deputy director, routinely receives the president's daily brief. We're talking about the nation's most closely guarded secrets.
So if he's exempted from a security standard that the rank and file must follow, how is that not an immediate national security and morale risk?
It creates an immediate palpable double standard within the Bureau. The FBI claimed the officials were exempt as Schedule C political appointees.
But security experts immediately refuted that.
They did. And more damningly, when sources checked the official plumbook, Only one of the three officials, Nicole Rucker, was actually listed as a political appointee.
Which completely undermines the Bureau's stated defense.
And the impact on morale is only magnified by the fact that Director Patel has reportedly used polygraphs on his own rank and file staff to ferret out leaks or negative internal comments.
So critics are arguing this is clear evidence of prioritizing personal loyalty over established nonpartisan security procedures.
Exactly. The issue had been previously raised by Senator Durbin, and Patel deflected the question during testimony. So the question of the integrity of the Bureau's leadership and its security standards, it remains wide open.
Switching to congressional legal drama, U.S. Rep. Sheila Cherfliss McCormick was scheduled to appear outside a Miami federal courthouse on December 29th for an arraignment.
So that was rescheduled to January 20th. She faces 15 federal counts and has pleaded not guilty. The charges are highly specific. Conspiracy to steal $5 million in federal COVID-19 disaster funds.
And her attorney publicly tried to downplay the case, calling the alleged actions mistakes that shouldn't rise to the level of felonies.
He did, but a $100,000 diamond ring bought just weeks after receiving disaster funds. That detail sounds like a clear, high-risk political vulnerability, even if she pleads not guilty.
So why would her attorney downplay this as just mistakes?
Because the allegations are sensational. The indictment alleges the $5 million was overpaid to her family's healthcare company, Trinity Healthcare Services, which held a vaccination staffing contract.
And the ring.
The $100,000 purchase for a 3-carat yellow diamond ring for the congresswoman, happening within 2 months of receiving the funds in 2021, it just paints a picture that's far removed from a simple accounting mistake.
And the corruption charges extend beyond just the personal purchases.
Oh, absolutely. The charges include allegations that the stolen funds were then distributed to friends and relatives who then provided illegal straw donor contributions to her campaign for Congress.
So we're talking theft of government funds, money laundering.
A whole host of charges. Despite the gravity of it all, the judge allowed her to retain her congressional passport, and she remains committed to retaining her office and performing her duties.
We also saw a significant judicial check on executive power in the area of security clearance revocation.
Right. A federal judge blocked the administration's March presidential memorandum, which was aimed at revoking the security clearance of whistleblower attorney Mark Zaid.
And Zaid was one of 15 named targets in that memorandum, wasn't he?
He was. It was a list that included high-profile political adversaries like former President Joe Biden and his family and former Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco.
Zaid, of course, famously represented the intelligence community whistleblower, whose account led to the president's first impeachment in his first term.
Which is why this ruling is so critical, not just for Zaid, but for the entire legal community. It is a major check on the executive's use of security clearance status as a political tool.
So what did the judge say?
The judge granted a preliminary injunction, explicitly calling the memorandum improper political retribution and emphasizing that courts will enjoin the government from penalizing lawyers for representing parties adverse to it.
So it clarifies the rules of the road.
It does. It clarifies that while the government can still try to revoke a clearance through normal, neutral agency processes, it cannot use a sweeping presidential memorandum designed specifically to target political adversaries.
Okay, let's pivot hard now to domestic policy and the regulatory state.
Yeah.
The sheer volume of regulation enacted on December 29th shows the administration did not slow down for the holidays.
Not at all. And we have to start with the single largest domestic initiative of the year, the $50 billion Rural Health Transformation Program, or RHT.
This is arguably the most significant domestic policy intervention of the first year. It perfectly showcases a kind of, what would you call it? Interventionist conservatism.
That's a good way to put it. It's a massive centralized capital injection into the rural interior, managed by CMS Administrator Dr. Mehmet Oz.
And the fund is authorized for $50 billion across 5 years, so $10 billion annually.
That's the scale.
So what is the core mission? And more importantly, what's the political mechanism attached to it?
The core mission is straightforward. It's a direct subsidy intended to stop the critical, alarming rate of rural hospital closures across the country. It's about securing immediate stability for health access.
But the funding comes with strings attached.
Mandatory strings attached. Hospitals that receive funds must undergo mandatory technological modernization, specifically cybersecurity upgrades and a major expansion of telehealth capabilities.
So it's effectively integrating them into the national digital health grid.
Yes, but the true political ingenuity here is the discretionary portion of the funds.
The mechanism for political influence.
Exactly. Critics note that to qualify for these discretionary funds, states must align their health policies with the administration's priorities.
So it allows the federal executive, via Dr. Oz and CMS, to bypass state legislatures.
And influence health policy directly through hospital administrators. It's a form of political engineering designed to reward allies and shift state policies without needing any congressional buy-in.
And we saw specific capital deployments announced on December 29th that showed its wide reach across a political spectrum.
We did. Nebraska and Oklahoma, both led by Republican governors, secured large awards, $218.5 million and $223.5 million, respectively.
But look at the bipartisan appeal of the funds. New York also received a significant award.
$212 million, announced by Republican Rep. Nick Langworthy for the economically struggling Western New York and Southern Tier. This shows that while the policy might be politically engineered, the money is universally appealing. It ensures stability for key regional medical centers, regardless of the local politics.
We also saw action on land use and energy policy with the signing of the La Paz County Solar Energy and Job Creation Act.
This is a practical, almost paradoxical move. The law transfers 3,400 acres of federal land to La Paz County, Arizona, specifically for solar development.
Which is interesting, given the administration's championing of fossil fuels.
It is. This action signals a pragmatic recognition that renewables are supported when they generate local revenue and jobs, particularly in Republican districts. It aligns with a core devolution strategy.
Yeah.
Get federal land into local hands for economic benefit.
But that pragmatism contrasts sharply with the administration's stance on environmental regulation, specifically the fight over PFAS, or forever chemicals.
That's the EPA's proposed rollback of PFAS reporting rules. North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson is leading a powerful coalition of states opposing this move.
So that sets the stage for a major legal battle.
It does. A battle over environmental regulation that pits the federal government against states who feel the federal withdrawal of oversight leaves their citizens exposed to chemical contamination.
Next, let's look at the administrative hardening that's underway, specifically concerning immigration and agriculture. And this was all executed via these complex Federal Register maneuvers.
First, DHS and the DOJ issued a partial withdrawal of the incredibly complex 2020 Security Bars and Processing Asylum Rule. It was effective December 30th.
This looks arcane on the surface.
It is, but it was a precise technical legal necessity to maintain operational stability at the border.
Why was this withdrawal necessary to avoid legal chaos, as they put it?
Because the underlying complexity meant that if the original 2020 rule took full effect on December 31st, it would have created procedural conflicts with several other regulations passed in the meantime.
So by meticulously withdrawing only the conflicting instructions,
they clear the legal path to ensure the continued viability of the expedited removal process starting January 1st, 2026. They're essentially fixing a legal loophole that would have accidentally crippled their massive deportation machine.
So they're hardening the legal foundation of their border operation just before the new year.
Exactly. And simultaneously, the USDA is overhauling the Agricultural Foreign Investment Disclosure Act, or AFIDA.
They issued an advance notice of proposed rulemaking on the 29th.
And it's focused explicitly on national security. Currently, AFIDA, reporting on foreign land ownership, relies on self-disclosure, and it's easily skirted by shell companies and corporate veils.
So what's the fix? And why should the average listener care about, farm paperwork?
The fix is that the new rules will require beneficial ownership disclosure. This means the government will pierce the corporate veil to identify the ultimate foreign owners.
And the reason you should care?
The reason you should care is that this is the USDA being weaponized as a national security agency to counter China's strategic acquisition of U.S. farmland, particularly land located near key military installations or sensitive infrastructure. It's domestic economic stability tied directly to national security.
And on a more procedural but crucial modernization front, DHS issued a final rule requiring most Freedom of Information Act and Privacy Act requests to be electronic starting next month.
This is aimed entirely at efficiency. The department estimated that FOIA officers spend an unacceptable amount of time on manual data entry for paper requests.
So the push to digital frees them up.
It frees them up to spend more time actually reviewing records, which should theoretically speed up processing times. They wisely included an exception for the incarcerated, ensuring they still have an alternative submission method, but the push is clearly for digital efficiency.
Finally, in the regulatory state, we saw a massive, politically charged shift affecting the federal workforce, the OPM proposal concerning probationary employees.
And this text was teed up yesterday for Federal Register publication today, Tuesday. It dramatically alters both the latitude and the method for probationary federal employees to appeal their termination.
How so?
OPM is drastically limiting the grounds for appeal. Fired probationary employees, those generally within their first year of service, would only be allowed to appeal termination if they believe it was based on partisan political reasons, marital status, or clear procedural deviations.
That's a substantial loss of due process rights compared to the process for tenured employees. But the shift in adjudication is maybe the most profound change.
That is the functional takeaway. Appeals would move from the Merit Systems Protection Board, the MSPB, which is an independent quasi-judicial body,
to where?
To OPM's own Internal Merit System Accountability and Compliance, or MSAC, office.
So OPM is effectively moving the appeal process from an independent court to an internal department that reports to OPM itself. They're policing their own firings.
That is precisely the critique. OPM argues this increases efficiency and avoids MSPB quorum issues that have previously stalled work.
But under OPM's proposal,
probationary employees would generally lose the right to a hearing or a discovery phase. Decisions would be made only on a written record. It makes the termination process faster, less reviewable, and far more lethal for the employee.
This proposal makes a lot more sense when you remember the administration spent most of 2025 firing people and running into legal roadblocks regarding this exact probationary period.
They did. OPM is essentially cementing its ability to terminate these employees with minimal procedural friction going forward.
So while there's a legitimate argument that the federal probationary period has historically not been used effectively,
critics see the administration's primary focus as terminations rather than ensuring agencies retain highly qualified employees based on merit. It aligns perfectly with their goal of consolidating control over the bureaucracy.
Let's move on to technology, acquisition, and modernization. This year-end reflection highlights that acquisition, more than just IT, really dominated the federal technology news cycle in 2025.
That's a key finding that informs the rest of the tech landscape. And the context is high turnover. We saw nearly 85% of CFO Act agency CIOs leave in 2025.
That's an unprecedented level of attrition.
It is. And it meant that the conversation shifted from digital services to more foundational issues. The overhaul of the federal acquisition regulations, the GSA's OneGov initiative, and confirming key IT leaders. Acquisition became the choke point, not the technology itself.
One of the central shifts acknowledged was the evolution of the cybersecurity workforce, which was highlighted by the retirement of Rodney Peterson, the NIST Cyber Workforce Director.
Peterson's legacy really centered on the NICE framework, which is an internationally accepted taxonomy for describing cyber roles and the necessary skills.
And with thousands of competing cybersecurity education efforts, that framework is essential.
It is. It ensures a coordinated, unified approach across the U.S. ecosystem so that when someone says security architect, everyone understands the core competencies required.
And what about the persistent, critical discussion around skills-based hiring?
Well, there is increased awareness in government of the value of relying less on traditional degrees and more on explicit skills, knowledge, and capabilities. However, Peterson noted that the practice of it still lags.
So too many federal job announcements still require traditional credentials.
Exactly. And that disqualifies highly capable candidates who learned their trade through certifications or military service or just practical experience.
Let's also touch on behavioral change, which is notoriously difficult to achieve in cyber hygiene.
His assessment was blunt. While cybersecurity awareness programs get an A for effort and volume, the actual behavioral change they induce is likely closer to a C-.
Which emphasizes the need to move beyond simple yearly training.
And incorporate multimedia, simulation, and real-world testing to genuinely reinforce necessary behavioral changes, like avoiding those phishing links.
AI is the elephant in every room. Peterson outlined three critical impacts AI has on the cybersecurity workforce right now.
And these three are foundational to the future of defense. First, securing the AI technology itself by design, making sure the algorithms and models aren't exploitable.
Second is using it for defense.
Leveraging AI for defense.
Yeah.
Using it to write secure code faster or monitor for complex attack patterns. And third, and this is the most challenging, defending against AI-generated attacks, which can be deployed with greater speed and sophistication than human-generated ones.
So the cycle is secure it, use it, and defend against it.
That's it.
diving back into acquisition and IT transformation, two initiatives specifically surprised experts with their progress in 2025, the FAR overhaul and the radical reimagining of the FedRAMP program.
FedRAMP 20X, launched in March 2025, was described as a genuinely radical reimagining of a program that had become synonymous with, you know, compliance friction and paperwork.
What do they do?
GSA's leadership successfully overhauled the authorization framework to be cloud-native, automation-driven, and focused on continuous security validation rather than a one-time paper audit.
That sounds like a massive cultural shift for government compliance.
It absolutely is. Experts were impressed by the speed of this evolution, moving towards security over paperwork, to dramatically reduce the time it takes for cloud providers to gain authorization to work with federal agencies. It's an example of how entrenched compliance programs can evolve rapidly when they're given strong leadership.
We also saw the Cybersecurity Maturity Model Certification, CMMC 2.0, implementation hitting the runway at the Department of Defense.
And this is critical for every company that contracts with the DoD. CMMC is moving from just a policy proposal to a real mandatory award-gating mechanism.
So certification will be a required qualification.
DoD's implementation began phase one in November. This will radically influence acquisition strategy, contracting practice, and supply chain resilience across the entire defense industrial base. It's a huge deal for industry partners.
And Zero Trust Architecture, ZTA, has moved beyond being just a mandate from OMB.
Correct. ZTA transitioned in 2025 from a bureaucratic checkbox to an operational must-have, and is converging naturally with AI governance.
And the significant cultural shift is that IT professionals are now seeing it differently.
They now view ZTA not as a burden, but as an enabler of secure cloud adoption and hybrid work. It helps agencies reduce their attack surface and establish replicable security patterns across the vast enterprise.
And we have to touch on the theoretical future of digital interaction in the federal space. Agentic experience, or AX.
This is the model where humans direct intelligent systems to deliver desired outcomes. AX fundamentally flips the traditional user experience model, which is necessary for government efficiency.
Can you give us an example?
Sure. Instead of a human spending an hour performing every procedural step logging into four different legacy systems, retrieving forms, cross-referencing data, an intelligent agent does it for you.
So it authenticates on your behalf.
It retrieves the data, completes the tasks, and presents only the final synthesized output for human review and sign-off. The human guides the outcome, but the agent executes the laborious mechanics.
The potential application in the federal space is massive, given the complexity of the systems.
Think about the potential for streamlining complex workflows at CMS for compliance reports or simplifying benefit requests at the VA. But for AX to be trustworthy, it has to adhere to six principles that echo human-centered design.
Give us those principles.
They are transparency, so users understand what the agent did and why. Controllability, so humans remain in charge. It has to be contextual, reliable, adaptive, and most importantly, ethical, aligned with organizational and societal values.
And the main challenge?
The main challenge for the government moving forward isn't the AI itself, but modernizing the underlying data infrastructure to allow these agents to navigate safely and effectively.
So wrapping up the technology segment, let's address the biggest challenge emerging from 2025 and moving into 2026.
Most experts pointed to the massive attrition of the acquisition and tech workforce, the staggering loss of experienced contracting officers and newer tech-savvy feds. That will inevitably hinder the speed of IT modernization.
But the most significant emerging challenge is the rush to adopt and use AI.
The classic readiness gap.
Exactly. While the upside's huge, there remains a massive gap in terms of appropriate governance, well-defined use cases, clean, bias-free data availability, and workforce preparedness.
So agencies risk simply throwing expensive AI at process symptoms rather than addressing root cause problems if they rush adoption without mature governance in place.
Now for our last major section, space, economic headwinds, and judicial surveillance. A fascinating mix of high-flown ambition and ground-level reality from December 29th.
Let's start with NASA under its new administrator, Jared Isaacman.
Isaacman, the billionaire entrepreneur and commercial astronaut, was sworn in recently. And December 29th marked the acceleration of implementation for Executive Order 14369.
The title alone, Ensuring American Space Superiority, signals a hawkish, security-driven restructuring of civil space priorities.
And the mandates within that executive order are clear political and technological pushes. They're designed to ensure visible results during this presidential term.
First, they're accelerating Artemis to achieve a crewed moon landing by 2028, a clear political achievement goal.
Second, mandating the deployment of nuclear propulsion and reactors in space by 2030.
Which is critical for high-energy operations and future Mars missions. And third, explicitly linking civil space to national security with the mandate to counter threats to U.S. space interests.
Which effectively blurs the decades-old line between NASA and the Space Force.
It does. And the fourth mandate is the commercial-first solution. A direct rejection of the traditional cost-plus model that inflated traditional aerospace projects for decades.
This officially validates the fixed-price service model pioneered by companies like SpaceX.
It does. However, the internal conflict is represented by concerns over a leaked Project Athena document.
And what does that suggest?
It suggests a potential shift in budget priority away from Earth science and climate monitoring, you know, traditional NASA missions, in favor of human exploration and lunar industrialization. It suggests a move away from climate concerns and towards space dominance.
Okay, turning to economic indicators and fiscal health, some worrying news was released on December 29th that directly challenges the administration's narrative of economic stability.
The Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas reported its Manufacturing Outlook Survey's General Business Activity Index fell significantly to -10.9.
And for those unfamiliar with the metric, a negative reading indicates contraction in that key industrial sector.
Right. And given that Texas is a manufacturing powerhouse, a decline of that magnitude signals that the national industrial base is under severe stress.
Likely struggling with high costs, tight credit.
Persistent high costs, tight credit, and lingering supply chain issues. This decline directly contradicts the optimistic rhetoric projected by the administration regarding domestic economic strength and challenges that whole notion of widespread economic stability.
And this manufacturing contraction contrasts sharply with the continued stability of Treasury operations, however.
It does. Treasury bill auction rates for the 13-week and 26-week bills remain stable, around 3.5%.
Which, despite the massive debt issuance required for new spending programs like the $50 billion Rural Health Fund,
indicates that the market is successfully absorbing that debt. Global demand for the dollar as a safe haven, despite any domestic instability, remains extremely high.
On the judicial front, we saw two major legal moves by the Department of Justice, both of which seem to signal pre-2026 election positioning.
First, the Solicitor General filed an emergency application to the Supreme Court to stay the lower court injunction against the Corporate Transparency Act, the CTA.
And the CTA requires millions of small businesses to report their beneficial owners to FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network.
And the government's argument to the Supreme Court is that the current pause cripples law enforcement's ability to combat money laundering, terrorist financing, and the use of shell companies to hide illicit funds.
And Justice Alito requested a response,
which indicates the court is engaging with this rapidly evolving case, which really pits privacy rights against intense financial surveillance needs.
And second, the DOJ sued 21 states and the District of Columbia to force the turnover of voter registration data.
This is an extremely aggressive litigation strategy, and it's positioned under the politically charged narrative of election integrity.
The administration claims the goal is to verify citizenship and clean up voter rolls nationally.
But the states view this as federal overreach and a gross violation of voter privacy. The timing suggests the administration is preparing the legal battlefield for the 2026 midterms, seeking to centralize control or oversight of this highly sensitive voter registration data.
Finally, we must discuss accountability and the massive alleged fraud crisis unfolding in Minnesota's social service programs. The scale here is impossible to ignore.
It is, and the federal response on December 29th was swift. Estimates suggest up to $9 billion in alleged loss since 2018, primarily through sham child care centers exploiting federal and state funds.
Let's put that scale into human context. That number is nearly double the amount the administration just invested in the entire Rural Health Fund.
It shows a near total breakdown in oversight.
So what federal action did we see on the 29th?
We saw DHS ICE agents on the ground conducting site visits, confirming reports of empty child care centers that had received millions in federal funds.
And FBI Director Kash Patel made a public statement.
He did, stating that this is merely the tip of a very large iceberg, suggesting the fraud is systemic and widespread.
And the administration is using significant financial leverage here, too.
Absolutely. The SBA, the Small Business Administration, announced it is pausing federal loans to the state of Minnesota. This financial move signals that the federal government sees the state's regulatory environment as too risky for further investment until the fraud is demonstrably contained and controls are in place.
And the issue is highly partisan, which just complicates any resolution.
It does. Republicans are leveraging the issue politically, calling for Governor Waltz's resignation. Democrats in the state have remained largely quiet.
And the situation is made even more sensitive by the demographic details.
The fact that 90% of the federal charges target members of the Somali community involved in sham businesses forces a highly sensitive public discussion about the pervasive nature of the fraud and the community affected. This crisis demonstrates that while the federal government is busy projecting global stability, massive fraud is eroding domestic stability due to oversight failure.
That brings us to the end of our exhaustive deep dive into December 29th, 2025. It was a single day that provided a stunning portrait of this administration's governing philosophy in motion.
Massive action across the board, operating under that strategic theme of consolidation of power and projection of stability.
It was a demonstration of strategic synchronization.
From orchestrating an $8.6 billion foreign military deal for deep strike capabilities against Iran, to redefining job protections for new federal employees to streamline the bureaucracy, to launching a massive domestic healthcare fund designed to politically influence states, all while hardening the legal foundation for a major border removal operation.
Every single action was consequential and aimed at reshaping policy domestically or internationally.
So what does this all mean for you, the learner, as you reflect on this unprecedented volume of activity? We've covered the immediate spending, the F-15 deals, the P-8 Poseidons, that $50 billion rural health fund.
These actions buy immediate stability and political achievement. But let's connect that short-term confidence to the long-term challenge.
The provocative thought to consider is the ultimate trade-off embedded in this administration's policies. We see massive targeted spending today buying immediate political confidence and economic stability for key constituents.
Simplified by the RHT fund and the job security from that Boeing contract extension.
But this spending occurs against a grim and largely ignored fiscal reality. The reality highlighted by GAO concerns is the nation's accelerating trajectory toward a $30 trillion national debt and a $2 trillion annual deficit.
So the question for you to mull over is this. Does the immediate visible stability bought by such enormous federal spending today, the F-15s, the health fund, the nuclear space push, does it justify the long-term fiscal unsustainability that these policies appear to be accelerating?
Especially given the continuous inaction and lack of any serious foundational debate on fiscal reality in Congress. It's a trade-off between today's projected confidence and tomorrow's economic burden.
A profound thought to end the year on. Thank you for diving deep with us today.
Always a pleasure. We hope this exhaustive breakdown helps you navigate the intricacies of the federal landscape with greater clarity.